Gentlemen, this is Division 5 of the Court of Appeals, and we are going to hear three arguments this morning. Two are set for the 9 o'clock docket, first of which is Downs against State Farm. I see that counsel are present, set up. Thank you very much. And without further ado, we'll hear from you, Mr.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. My name is Thomas Seaman. I am attorney for the appellant, State Farm. We appreciate this opportunity to present this argument to you this morning. As I looked at this over the weekend and tried to gather my thoughts as to how we would proceed here, one of the things that became abundantly clear is that the number of issues that are raised on appeal in this case are many. Started out actually with 9, and now it's up to 10 with a recent addition of the issue concerning the trial court's denial of our motion for new trial based on newly discovered evidence. And there's no way we're going to be able to discuss all 10 issues here today. Mr. Levine and I have been here before, and one of the things that we know that this court is serious about is the fact that you've read the briefs. So we're both relying on your knowledge of the issues based upon that review of the briefs. I hope to comment on a few of the issues that are before the court, and I'll trust our presentation of the rest of the issues in terms of the briefs that were submitted. One of the issues that I wanted to address is really the most recent issue raised in this case, and that is the issue of a denial of State Farm's motion for new trial based upon newly discovered evidence. This court remanded the case to the district court to allow consideration of that motion. The motion is based upon newly discovered evidence that we believe is very relevant because of the issues in this case in terms of the type of injuries. Plaintiff claimed that he had a traumatic brain injury and also claimed that he developed a seizure disorder as a result of the accident. The evidence that was developed post-trial indicated that there is a likelihood that plaintiff had a long history of alcohol and drug use and abuse. The affidavits that we submitted to this court that led to the remand order indicated that is relevant on both the issues of development of a seizure disorder and on the cognitive impairment issues. When the case got back to the trial court, the district court considered our motion. We filed the motion pursuant to Rule 60B-5, and we acknowledged it was filed more than 6 months after the judgment was entered, but we didn't discover the new evidence until more than 6 months after the judgment was entered in this case. What the court decided, well, the trial court never got to the issue of considering the three criteria for considering whether a new trial should be ordered based on newly discovered evidence. Those criteria are set forth in the Southeastern Colorado Water versus O'Neill case that we cited in our brief. And essentially the criteria, whether the evidence would have been discovered or should have been discovered prior to trial by the exercise of reasonable diligence, whether the evidence was material and relevant to an issue in the case, and whether the evidence would have likely changed the outcome of the case. Trial court never got to that because the court, in analyzing the motion, decided that it was a motion to challenge the credibility of the plaintiff in this case with regard to his testimony and deposition and a trial concerning his alcohol and drug use and abuse. And because it went to the credibility of the plaintiff, what the trial court decided was that it was really a Rule 60B-2 motion because it dealt with issues of fraud, misrepresentation, or other misconduct on the part of the plaintiff. We believe that ruling was an error. We think that the case law in Colorado allows a motion for new trial based on newly discovered evidence to be considered by a trial court under Rule 60B-5. We also, in that the Southeastern Colorado Water case versus O'Neill that I cited is one example of that consideration of a motion for a new trial based on newly discovered evidence being based on Rule 60B-5 and not 60B-2. The other case cited in our brief that I want to call the court's attention to is the Department of Public Health versus Calk case. And in that case, the court said that a party can seek relief under Rule 60B under more than one section of that rule. So even if the trial court is correct that the motion implicated issues of fraud or misrepresentation or other misconduct by the plaintiff, We think that the primary issue presented to the court in the Rule 60B, two motion was whether or not the evidence would have likely changed the outcome, and we really focused on the fact that it would have with the affidavits that we filed.
Well, Mr. Seaman, you were referring to this latter case, the department versus call. And in that case, did that involve a 60B5 motion as opposed to another subsection of Rule 60?
I'm not certain of that, Your Honor, and I apologize for not knowing the answer to that. I should know the answer. We cited the case just for the proposition that multiple sections of Rule 60B can be considered as a basis for the motion. And that despite the fact that the court linked this particular motion to 60B2, that doesn't eliminate a 60B5, for example, option for bringing the case. And if you think about it, since the six-month rule applies to 60B2 motions, without having that flexibility to argue it under Rule 60B5, there are, I think, many instances in which newly discovered evidence is not going to be discovered within that six-month time period, and an appellant would be barred from even raising that issue. And I don't think that's the intent of Rule 60B. If it was, the drafters of Rule 60B could just say that a motion for new trial based on newly discovered evidence has to be filed within 6 months of the trial, or else it's barred, and that's not what the rule provides or allowed.
Mr. Seaman, I have a question about that as well. Let's assume for the sake of argument that you have a piece of evidence that would affect the credibility of the plaintiff. If this is asserted before the 6 months under 60B2, is it evaluated under one standard? And then does that standard change if it's asserted as newly discovered evidence under 60B5? In other words, do you sense that there's some change in the standard of evaluation?
I don't, Your Honor. And I think that all you're attempting to do at that point is to clear the hurdle of getting it before the court under Rule 60B standard. And once the court agrees to consider that under Rule 60B, then they look at the quality and nature of the evidence and determine, based upon the three criteria in the Southeastern Water case, as to whether or not it's a basis to order a new trial or not.
So the factor that would govern whether you can get it in front of the court at all would be whether it should have been discovered by reasonable diligence.
I think so, Your Honor, and that's the position that we argued at the trial court, and the trial court rejected. What we're asking this court to do is one of two things. One option that I see this court is having is to enter a remand order and direct the district court to consider the motion for new trial pursuant to Rule 60B5 and apply the criteria, the three criteria, to determine whether a new trial is warranted based upon those criteria. The second option, which I think the court has, is to order a new trial based upon a performance of that analysis by this court based upon the evidence that is before this court in the record in this case. There are affidavits, you know the nature of the evidence that we're talking about, and I think this court can, if it chooses, decide to consider that evidence and enter that order and not, remand it to the trial court for consideration of that. The second issue that I wanted to address in this case is one that I thought, as I was looking at this, is really it sets forth a pretty unusual or bizarre set of facts. And it has to do with the trial court's investigation conducting during trial into the credibility of a witness who observed the plaintiff operating a vehicle on a first day of trial. The plaintiff had a seizure, which led to a mistrial on the first day of trial, and while he was being treated at the Rose Medical Center for that seizure on the first day of trial, a nurse at Rose Medical Center observed and made a record of him leaving the emergency room, and in that record she indicated that he left Rose Medical Center by private automobile with the plaintiff driving that vehicle. Plaintiff's driving and his ability to drive, whether he can drive or whether he was driving, was a big issue in this case, a very big issue. And it was an issue that was emphasized by the plaintiff in arguing that the plaintiff's damages were heightened or increased as a result of his inability to drive. What the trial court did, and we got that record 3 or 4 days into trial, what the trial court did when we asked the court to be allowed to introduce evidence and have that witness come to court and testify. It was really to start her own investigation into the issue. And on the first day that she attempted that, she talked to the plaintiff's mother, who happened to be in the courtroom, and just asked her, not under oath, you know, no, you know, testimony as such, whether or not she was present at the hospital, and she said she was. She then said, well, did your son, the plaintiff, drive a car away from the hospital? The mother said, no, he did not. I drove the car. And the judge said, I trust the mother. And the judge said, what we all know is that nurses often make mistakes in notes. And we think that that approach to the issue was wrong. We think it was further compounded the next day when we found out from the court, and this happened in a bench conference, that the court had continued the investigation by having her law clerk call the nurse at Rose Medical Center to interview her over the phone. And what the court told us at the bench and what the law clerk eventually testified to are different versions of that conversation. The judge indicated that she understood that the nurse had indicated that what she really meant by the comment in her record is that the plaintiff left the hospital under his own steam and was not in a wheelchair or didn't leave by ambulance. What the law clerk said, who testified outside the presence of the jury, is that he asked the nurse whether her reference to leaving the vehicle or leaving the hospital driving a vehicle or in a private vehicle with the plaintiff driving had some unique or unusual meaning in a hospital emergency room vernacular that, you know, was different than what the ordinary common understanding would be. The nurse responded, it means exactly what it says. And the nurse shortly after that hung up on the law clerk, would not accept his callback, and so we were left with that uncertainty with regard to that. Our position was the court should not have conducted that investigation. It was the jury's function and not the court's to determine whether that witness would be credible or not.
Mr. Seaman, was there an objection lodged below to that procedure?
To the court,
to the procedure of the court having a law clerk investigate?
We had no idea that we would have known that it went on. The way we learned of that, Your Honor, is on the second day, after the investigation that involved the interview of the mother, I asked to approach the bench after the plaintiff attorney had asked my claim manager from State Farm whether she was aware that the plaintiff was restricted from driving. And so I asked the court in a bench conference whether I could now ask the witness, the State Farm witness, whether she was also now aware of the fact that there was evidence that he was in fact driving. The court said that she wasn't going to allow the evidence, and then she indicated that since she had begun the investigation the day before, she now had the results of a conversation that her law clerk had had on the phone with this nurse. And that wasn't something the court advised us was going to happen, that she planned to do. And it seemed obvious to me at the time that the judge must not have been that confident with part one of her investigation because she continued it with part two, having the law clerk conduct that conversation.
Mr. Seaman, to follow up on my colleague's question, at the time the law clerk is made known to you and you have the bench conference, did you lodge an objection at that time?
We did, Your Honor, and I think at that time is when we asked the court. Well, it was either that time or shortly thereafter that we asked the court to establish or allow us to establish a record as to what was actually stated in the conversation or in the interview with the law clerk.
And I assume that you considered taking a CAR 21 petition at that point, or?
No, Your Honor. I mean, we were in like the fourth or fifth day of trial at that point in time. And, you know, we had to make a decision. You know, I suppose we could have attempted that. We could have asked the court to declare a mistrial, but it was clear that the court felt that she hadn't done anything wrong, that it was her function to explore the credibility of this witness before deciding whether the witness would be allowed to testify, and we think that that usurped the jury's function of the case.
Mr. Seaman, would you briefly address your colleague's observation that this evidence was hearsay and the records weren't authenticated, and therefore the whole thing was inadmissible?
Well, we weren't planning to introduce the record. We were planning to call the witness to testify. I mean, this was a witness that had no involvement in the case until the trial had started. So we didn't. It wasn't our intent to try to introduce this unsubstantiated record as an exhibit and rely on that. What we asked the court to do is allow us to call a nurse to testify in court as to what she saw, let the jury decide whether she was believable or not.
Well, Mr. Seaman, my reading of the records, the court also determined that calling the nurse would pretty much require rebuttal and surrebuttal, and it was somewhat of a sideshow taking over the circus, and she wasn't.
And we disagree with that for the reasons stated in our brief. We think the testimony would have been very short, probably 15 minutes or less. Certainly, the plaintiff could have cross-examined the nurse as to whether she really saw it. You know, what did you see? What, you know, where were you? All of that. And it would have been relatively short, but it was an important enough issue to this case with regard to the driving issue, because that was huge in this case in terms of whether the plaintiff could operate a vehicle. And it went to the whole issue of, you know, whether he could seek employment, whether he could socialize with his friends, whether he could hold down a job if he were to find a job. It permeated every aspect of the plaintiff's damages case, and we think it was highly questionable.
Mr. Seaman, we've kept you up here for quite a while with questions, so we're going to give you a minute for rebuttal.
Okay, thank you for that.
Mr. Morning, may it please the court. I'm Bradley Levine, represent the plaintiff appellee, Travis Downs, with respect to this matter. What I'm going to do is I'm going to address the issues that Mr. Seaman has raised to the court. First of all, let's talk about the issue involving Rule 60B, and specifically the ruling by the court with respect to the timeliness of this particular motion. What the court found, what the trial court properly found after this court had remanded the case to the trial court on the Rule 60 motion, what the court determined was is that it came within the aegis of Rule 60B2. What the court determined, and again, we feel appropriately, found that at its essence, no matter how it is that the defendant, State Farm, is trying to characterize it to qualify their motion, call it what you will, what they're basically doing is they're making an attack on the credibility of Travis Downs, suggesting that what he did is that he lied under oath with respect to the issues of drug and alcohol abuse. That was a claim of fraud or misrepresentation by Mr. Downs. And that comes within the aegis of Rule 60B2. The notion, first of all, let me address the question of whether, when you have a claim which is brought under Rule 60B, if you are trying to rely on the residual clause, the clause is very clear. It uses the term any other basis. In other words, the court, this court, has determined, and specifically we cited in the our brief the In Re Adoption of PHA case, the McIlvaney versus Batley court case. Those cases stand for the proposition that you rely on the residuary clause 60B5 only in the instance where it doesn't come within B1 through B4. And so the court appropriately determined here that it came within the aegis of B2. When you call it newly discovered evidence, in other words, this whole notion that simply because it has been quote unquote newly discovered and that occurs after the 6 months has expired, there is nothing in the rule that says that just simply because you discover this, albeit, and again, if the court looks at the various other subsections, if you're talking about, for example, if there's some kind of excusable neglect, if you talk about whether or not the judgment's void and so on, there's nothing in the rule that allows for an exception based upon the fact that, well, we discovered there was this fraud or whatever it is, and of course it's all alleged in this case, but that we discovered this misrepresentation or fraud, we discovered a year later or 2 years later and so on. The rule is absolutely clear that that is a motion that needs to be brought within 6 months. If you're talking about sub one or sub two, which includes the notion of fraud or misrepresentation. Now, And in terms of, you know, the rationale behind it, obviously the drafters of this rule, and you know, we have a similar rule in under the Federal Rules of Procedure, have determined that for certain types of motions under Rule 60 to try to get relief from an order or judgment, that there has to be some sense of finality. And of course, the Supreme Court in our state has indicated even if you come under B5, that you have to establish that there are extraordinary circumstances. What the courts in this state and certainly the drafters of Rule 60B determined is that there has to be a certain sense of finality at a certain point that our entire judicial system is going to be founded on the notion that once you have an order, that we have to have finality at some point, that you don't have an instance such as we had in this case, which is some 2 years later, that you have someone come out of the woodwork, someone who we claim, and again, now I'm getting into the substance of what it is that we had argued if the court had gone that far, that you have someone come out of the woodworks 2 years later and say, hey, listen, I've got some evidence that we believe that State Farm certainly could have adduced during the pretrial proceedings, that it didn't have to come out, 2 years after a two-week trial had been conducted, when you had all kinds of witnesses testifying about these kinds of issues, and that suddenly someone comes along 2 years later and you say, oh, wait a minute, we get an entirely new trial because there's this individual who has got some kind of evidence. And of course, there's real questions, and again, I don't think we need to get into it here, but there's some real questions about the quality of that evidence and so on. But the point is that we've got the Canton Oil case, which obviously, again, we're talking about B-5, and again, we don't even have to get there. The upshot is what the trial court did in this instance is apply the rule, and as it's been interpreted by this court, and said that this is at its essence. And I didn't even hear Mr. Seaman when he just spoke to this court disagree with the fact that what we had here was a claim of fraud or misrepresentation by Travis Downs with respect to his drug and alcohol use.
Well, Mr. Levin, let me ask you this. It was my understanding in listening to Mr. Seaman's argument today that he was suggesting that the evidence went to causation of the damages separate from credibility. And was that presented below?
The upshot, Your Honor, doesn't make any difference. I mean, whether you have to do with in terms of causation, whether or not the reason that he had, problems, a head injury and so on, whether or not it's causation, whether it goes to credibility, doesn't matter. I mean, the upshot is that what they are talking about here is a question of whether or not there was some type of fraud or misrepresentation, because that's what the evidence that they presented to the trial court. And that's what the trial court ruled on, that evidence went to the question of whether or not Travis Downs lied or not. Call it what they will, and they may not have used the term lie, but call it what you will, that's what they were saying. They were saying that Travis Downs, when he said that he didn't drink alcohol or he didn't abuse drugs, that he was lying either in his deposition or his trial testimony, that he wasn't being forthright about those issues. And then they tried to present evidence from a neuropsychologist that said that, had we known about that, that could be something that could impair his ability to be able to cognate and so on. But the upshot of it is that, again, if it goes to causation, if it goes to credibility, it doesn't make any difference. It nonetheless is a claim that there was some type of misrepresentation by Travis Downs with respect to drug and alcohol abuse.
Following the logic of your position here, counsel, can you give me an example then of evidence that would be admissible under 60B-5? I mean, it seems to me if the plaintiff testifies to all the elements of his case, wouldn't any evidence essentially contradict his testimony and then be inadmissible according to your analysis?
Well, no, I mean, under Rule 60B-5, I mean, if we're talking about credibility kinds of issues, that may very well be the case, Your Honor.
So that it never
but again, no. I mean, but 60B-5 has a very broad use. I mean, let's look at the Canton Oil case as an example. What that case involved was that there was evidence that came out, well after the fact, but that there were that one or more of the jurors had harbored some religious biases, and that had infected, that had impaired what the jury was going to do. So in other words, 60B-5 has got some very broad uses that may not be covered under B-1 through B-4. So it has a place, and if we look at the various cases that apply B-5, like Canton Oil is just one example of that, where it does have a place. All I'm suggesting to you is, yes, Your Honor, if we're talking about credibility issues, if you're talking about saying that the evidence we have contradicts what the plaintiff testified to at trial or in his deposition, that is a question of some kind of misrepresentation. I mean, that is what you're alleging, and that's a matter that needs to be brought within 6 months. That's what the rule says, and that's what State Farm did not do in this case. Let me turn to the other issue, again, that Mr. Seaman did argue, and again, I agree that there are a lot of other issues that they have raised, and I certainly can and will address those if I have the time to do it.
Mr. Levine?
Yes, Your Honor.
On this issue that you're about to turn to, let me ask, where a trial judge engages in conduct during the course of trial that's barred by the Code of Judicial Responsibility, does that automatically require a mistrial?
Your Honor, that's an issue, first of all, obviously, that has not been raised by State Farm. They never couched anything in that respect, whether or not there was some type of conduct that was anathema to the Code of Judicial Professional Responsibility. The answer to your question is I don't believe so. The question is you know, obviously, it's like if there is a, if a lawyer somehow acts contrary to the Code of Professional Responsibility that governs lawyers, obviously that is something in the courts in this case, in this state, have been very clear about that, that that is something to be dealt with in a separate type of proceeding.
What happens if in a trial, for example, a trial judge has ex parte communication with counsel, one counsel, and the second counsel finds out about it? Is that time for a mistrial?
There are cases, reported cases in the state, where you have had that happen, where you have had ex parte communications, and the courts have dealt with it. Is that a time for a mistrial? It potentially is under those circumstances, Your Honor. And, you know, certainly in this case, of course, there never was any kind of a motion for mistrial that was made by State Farm.
Isn't the situation where a trial judge engages in investigation outside the courtroom, isn't that ex parte conduct?
It could be characterized as an ex parte conduct. I would agree with that, Your Honor. Your Honor, I'm not here to, and I am not, you know, to condone or basically to try to justify that aspect in terms of what this judge did. That's not my point of being here. The question ultimately here is whether or not it was appropriate under these circumstances for the court to rule that there was not going to be either a continuance of the trial or that there wasn't going to be an allowance of some kind of, as Judge Lichtenstein was talking about, that there's going to be some type of, if you will, some type of a mini trial based upon these records. And first of all, I think it is important. It is integral to this court's consideration of the record, the fact that the medical record upon which this entire their appeal is based with respect to this matter is not in the record. It was something was marked. It was marked as Exhibit EE. It was incumbent upon State Farm and their counsel to make it part of the record. In fact, what they did, they said, as far as their offer of proof in terms of what that document said, they said this record, this exhibit, is our offer of proof. And yet they did not do anything to make it part of the record. It is not part of the record that is before this court. They attempted to put it into the record through a motion, and the motions panel of this court denied it and said that basically the record's going to stand as it was in the trial court. That is a problem as far as prosecuting this particular issue on appeal. If we go to the next step, however, well, the court didn't denominate it such, but essentially what the court was doing was conducting, and they used the term an investigation, but it's no different as part of whatever kind of gatekeeping function that a trial court has to determine whether or not evidence is going to be allowed under Rules 402 and 403. And what the court ultimately determined, the court had previously determined, and appropriately so, that all this evidence about Mr. Downs' seizure that caused the first mistrial, the dismissal of the first jury panel and the impaneling the second panel, that the evidence of that seizure was not going to become part of this case, and that that discretionary ruling was an appropriate ruling. So you have to look in the context of that ruling that had already been made looking at this whole issue of, okay, whether or not we're going to have this, if you will, mini trial, whether or not it takes, as Mr. Seaman says, 15 minutes, half hour, hour, whatever it is, the question about this record, and again, that record is not in the file before this court, but whether or not this purported record that said something about whether or not Travis Downs was driving a vehicle, whether or not that was something that was going to be allowed in front of this jury, because obviously there's going to be context. So then the next question is, what was he doing in the hospital, right? Some 4 or 5 days before that. Well, he had a seizure. And of course, now what we're doing is that we're revisiting the whole issue that she'd already said we're not going to get into. And again, these are discretionary rulings by the trial court in, you know, the overall functioning in terms of the, it's like I say, in terms of any kind of gatekeeping as far as the processing of this trial and what evidence is or is not going to be allowed. You know, we already had a two-week trial. There's extensive testimony in the question whether or not we're going to allow us to now get into what essentially would be a mini trial based upon the seizure that had happened. And of course, then that opens the door to the other argument that State Farm had made that, well, the question about a seizure means that he wasn't being compliant with his medications. And, you know, we now are just essentially opening the door to a whole new round of testimony and so on. So Judge Graham, just particular to your questioning, and I appreciate it, and I guess the word I would use is that it certainly was an unusual proceeding for the trial court judge to have done that in this case, for Judge Rappaport to have conducted that. But ultimately, that's not the cogent issue from my client's standpoint as to whether or not there was a fair trial and whether or not the rulings that were made by the court ultimately were appropriate. How the court may have gotten there, I understand that there might be some questions from the panel with respect to that. Ultimately, however, we believe that the rulings were appropriate, and we would ask that the judgment be affirmed, except for, as we've indicated, with the exception that we believe that we should get the full amount of non-economic damages that the jury had awarded. If there are other questions, I thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Levine.
One of life's mysteries is how that exhibit double E didn't make it into the record, because our designation of record on appeal clearly listed it. It said Rose Medical Records, the plaintiff's visit to the emergency room on January 16th of 2007. It's item 3 on our designation of record, and we were flabbergasted actually when plaintiff's counsel made the argument in response to our brief that wasn't in the record, and we asked to supplement the record, and the court denied that. But as pointed out in our reply brief, that record was read verbatim into the record, and it's at the transcript on January 29, 2007, at page 168, lines 15 through 21. So it's part of the record. It was read out loud verbatim into the record, and then we made our offer proof based upon that. So it was clear that the court had that before it understood what it was, and I think we did establish that in the record.
And just to be sure, it's clear if from the record, the existing record, that you were seeking to admit the testimony of the nurse and not the record itself.
That was our intent, Your Honor, and I think we made that very clear to the court, and I think what the court undertook was an improper investigation of the credibility issue as to that witness. We didn't move for a mistrial, but if counsel is suggesting that by failing to move for a mistrial we waive the right to raise this on appeal, we disagree. Moving for a mistrial is a major decision in a lengthy trial. My client was there. I conferred with my client, and we discussed what our options were. So we chose the option to proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Seaman.
Thank you.
Court thanks counsel for both sides for their excellent arguments, helpful.